move to, see, case number four, Harris versus McCourty.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Richard McLeese and I represent Terry Harris, the appellant. Your Honor, this case raises quite a narrow issue, a single issue that's quite narrow, and the issue put procedurally is whether the district judge erred in denying us an evidentiary hearing on the question of whether there existed cause for a habeas petitioner Terry Harris's failure to raise a particular claim of ineffective assistance of counsel in his prior state proceedings, his prior state post-conviction proceeding in which he proceeded pro se. Putting the issue legally, the question I submit is whether, as the district judge employed, a form of strict liability, liability without fault, is appropriately to be applied to this issue, at least insofar as the reason for the failure to raise the issue previously is not what's been called external to the defense, or whether a fault-based approach should be used across the board. And our position, of course, is that a fault-based approach should be used, and that at an evidentiary hearing, which would be quite limited, would probably be a two-witness hearing, that we would be able to establish that Harris could not reasonably be faulted for failing to raise this claim previously in light of his pro se status and in light of his very limited intelligence reflected by an IQ score of 76, which is right on the cusp of mental retardation.
Let me ask you, do you have any cases that hold that his pro se status or ignorance or borderline mental retardation constitute cause?
I do not have any cases that hold that any of those items in isolation constitute cause. The issue here, I submit, one of the critical differences in this case is that we're not talking, and I'm not just relying on pro se status constituting a basis, nor am I relying on the mental disability. What I'm relying on here is the cumulative effect of these factors. And I don't believe that there are any cases that hold against us on that issue, meaning that those factors in the aggregate cannot constitute cause as a matter of law.
In any of those cases, are those borderline mental retardation cases versus those where it's very clear, you know, that the IQ is 56 or 60 or something like that? Because here, I mean, I think that's part of the problem for you is the fact that he's borderline. You know, we might not be here if he was at 56 or 60.
Well, when you say that that's part of the problem, obviously our case would be stronger were his IQ lower. However, it seems to me that the critical question here is whether Harris, in light of his limited intelligence and his organic brain damage, could reasonably be expected to have raised this claim on his own without the assistance of counsel or the assistance of a mental health expert. And it seems to me, Your Honor, and again, this would be something that would be developed in an evidentiary hearing, that whether somebody is 74, 68, 76, that a strong argument can be made that there is not reason for the person to be aware of the factual predicates for the claim, namely his mental retardation and his organic brain damage.
And how does that square with his petition that was 63 pages that raised a number of articles? How do you, you know, have that on the one hand and an argument you're making here?
There are several ways that I could respond to that, but I think the clearest and strongest way is that the claims made in the petition were things for which he had some reasonable basis to be aware of the factual predicate of the claim. It was something that happened in court that he saw that the judge did, the lawyer did, whomever. He had reason to know of the factual predicate. Here, once again, The argument is that somebody who is borderline mentally retarded and also suffers from organic brain damage, in the absence of counsel and in the absence of a mental health expert, could not reasonably be expected to know of that factual predicate. Certainly, particularly with intelligence, there have been many instances in the cases where people who were clearly far more retarded than this individual, seemingly competent counsel at the outset did not detect that, and there are all kinds of reasons for that. Among them, the people who are mentally retarded or borderline mentally retarded can become very skilled at seeming to compensate for that disability, and they can nod, and you think they understand what you're saying, but they don't. And again, these are reasons why I submit that this is not an issue that can properly be disposed of as a matter of law.
But doesn't it, in fact, he filed this 60-page post-conviction petition on his own, I gather, right?
Well, with the assistance of other inmates.
No, right. I mean, that's... But nevertheless, cuts against this use of the borderline mentally retarded and the fact he was able to carry that through.
Well, if Your Honor's point that it suggests that he's not in fact borderline mentally retarded, or if Your Honor's point
that borderline is not sufficiently of itself to say that you don't know what you're doing and you can't do it well.
Okay.
But as a matter of fact, during World War II, the military, well, it was 60 was the lowest. You couldn't get in the army after 60. At 76, a number of them were non-commissioned officers. Just in the United States. One of the reasons non-commissioned officers, you had about 100 on the AGCT score, Megan, which would put you about 90.
Your Honor, once again, the question is not whether he could put together a petition that was based upon factual predicates that he could reasonably be aware of, namely the things that happened in court that he saw. The question, and a question which I submit expert testimony is necessary to resolve, is whether somebody who has this sort of limited mental functioning has reason to be aware of it. It's not like a broken arm where you look over here and you see, oh yeah, I got a broken arm.
I understand your position that he couldn't know that he has a score of 76 or whatever it was, but as Judge Barr pointed out, that maybe that doesn't mean anything because he's able to carry out and represent himself to some degree in this action. So what's the difference that he has at 76?
Well, the difference, Your Honor, is that based upon his limited intelligence and his inability to be aware of that as a factual matter, he couldn't reasonably be expected to have raised that. And we're relying on the same standard, fault-based standard, that's found in the AEDPA with respect to failure to present facts. And I submit, Your Honor, that whatever is included in the pro se petition, as long as that relies on facts that he could be aware of, is really irrelevant here. I'm not claiming that his arguments that he made there weren't as strongly made as they could have been, and therefore we ought to get a fresh start here. I'm relying on something else that I submit he could not reasonably have been aware of.
Now in this, so what you're saying is, in his amended petition, when he raised ineffective assistance claims before the state court, he didn't raise the whole IQ business and the organic brain dysfunction.
Well, when you say amended petition, I thought you were going to refer to the federal. We're talking about the state petition?
Right.
The state petition, he did not raise, and that's the whole problem from our standpoint. He did not raise this ineffective assistance claim based upon failure to investigate.
Right. He raised the ineffective
assistance. Well, he raised other instances of ineffective assistance, and those were things where the lawyer did one thing in court and didn't do something else. And, Your Honor, just briefly, while I understand Your Honor's point about IQ and so forth, I do think that it's important that we as lawyers, who all of whom can be assumed to have IQs of at least 120 and probably well above that, take seriously the fact that not everyone functions at that level. And whereas we may be in the top 10 or less percent of functioning, that shouldn't cause us to have blinders on the effects of limited mental capability for those who are at the bottom percent.
You have to recognize the fact that we're smarter than most people.
Yes.
That's a good idea.
Some of us.
Unless Your Honor has any further questions, I see that my time is up.
Not quite up, so you have a little bit.
All right. Well,
I just have one quick question. If he wins on this and he gets a hearing and he prevails at the hearing, could he be subject to retrial and then a potential death penalty sentence again?
The question, well, we're not seeking retrial. We're seeking a resentencing.
Right.
And I believe that the law is where once the death penalty, and it's an interesting procedural point, but I believe that the law is that once the death penalty has been rejected by a decision maker, at least in this state, under these circumstances, that he could not be subject to the death penalty. So the question is whether he gets natural life or whether he gets a term of years.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Iskowich.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. McLeese, may I please the court? My name is David Iskowich with the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent, the warden of the Menard Correctional Center. Mr. Harris's evidentiary hearing contention need not even be addressed by this court because none of the contingencies raised by him as cause for his blatant procedural default can withstand scrutiny as a matter of law. Mr. Harris's contention that he was proceeding pro se in the state post-conviction, with the state post-conviction petition and in those proceedings as a matter of law and under this court's jurisprudence cannot withstand scrutiny. This court has held several times, in particular in the Barksdale case and the Henderson versus Cone case, that an inmate's pro se status on post-conviction review does not constitute sufficient cause to excuse a procedural default. And this rule is somewhat based on the Finley case that inmates at this stage of state proceedings simply aren't entitled to the assistance of counsel.
What about his argument that it's the combination of things, the pro se status, ignorance, and the borderline mental retardation?
The cases that this court has decided with respect to cause and those kinds of factors, Your Honor, have been addressed, it seems, in the aggregate. In those two cases I cited, there are string cites. They say pro se status, lack of legal education, lack of legal training, failure to think like a lawyer. None of these things can stand for cause, and it would be our argument that even in the aggregate, this is not a substantial showing or a sufficient showing as cause for default. Since none of them can constitute cause for default, it makes no sense that two or three of them lumped together can constitute cause for default. I hope I answered the question. I think it bears noting.
So in other words, you're just saying you wouldn't envision any situation where all of those factors lumped together would change the outcome.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think with respect to this case in particular, it bears noting that in the district court opinion, Judge Pallmeyer wrote that Mr. Harris's allegations of organic brain damage and borderline mental retardation are so conclusory that the court is uncertain that they are even sufficient to require or warrant a response. I think we need to remember that with respect to his arguments for cause. Mr. Harris had the opportunity of Rule 6 discovery during the district court proceedings, the Rule 6 discovery to which we objected most vehemently. During that time, Mr. Harris was able to procure an expert. We don't know his name. We don't know his testing methods. We don't know his data. We don't know where he comes from. And he comes up with this claim that he has an IQ of 76, which Mr. Harris even conceded is borderline and is not mentally retarded in light of the Atkins versus Virginia case, which set the line at between 50 and 55 to 70, and that's mild mental retardation. So Mr. Harris falls way above that. And with respect to the organic brain damage, again, this opinion was tendered by a hired expert of whom we know nothing, and for which Mr. Harris had the opportunity of unbridled Rule 6 discovery in district court proceedings. And as with the other contingencies which the court has previously held do not constitute sufficient cause for default, pro se status, lack of legal education, and in the Collar versus Patella case, clinical depression, this organic brain damage in whatever manifestation it exists here, whether it's a very broad-based term, and it could encompass anything from impulsive behavior to irrational behavior to poor decision-making, that kind of thing. Like clinical depression, this is not an external factor. Mr. Harris might have it, he might not. It doesn't make a difference whether he has it or not. It cannot serve as cause for his default. And the district court properly realized that these were not sufficient excuses for the default, and properly dismissed the petition based on its defaulted nature. And I also want to add one thing with respect to Mr. Harris's argument that all of the claims raised in his pro se post-conviction petition were based on what he saw at trial. Mr. Harris raised, the court is aware, dozens upon dozens of constitutional claims. He was clearly aware of his Sixth Amendment right to the effective assistance of counsel, and he was aware that that right existed throughout all trial proceedings, whether trial or sentence. With respect to a sentencing hearing, Mr. Harris argued that his counsel should have procured more evidence in mitigation, not of the nature which Mr. Harris has raised in his habeas, but other evidence such as evidence of his good employment record and history of employment in the Chicago area. And these things were certainly outside of what was introduced at trial, since Mr. Harris claimed that this stuff should have been introduced at trial. And going back even further, I think it's important to note that the fact that this crime tend to get overlooked with all this procedural mishmash, but they certainly do not warrant any finding that Mr. Harris is anything other than coherent and was coherent back in 1984 and has been through his incarceration. The facts of this crime are horrible. They entail a forced kidnapping, a sexual assault, and various attempts to cover up the crime. Mr. Harris was gainfully employed at the time as an armed security guard, hardly a profession which would indicate that he is somewhere below average intelligence, and his attempts to cover up the crime, such as making phone calls to the victim's answering machine, asking her family where the victim was after the crime had occurred, certainly would indicate that he was functioning with a level of coherence which would belie any claim now that he is or has been even borderline mentally retarded. And if there are no further questions from the court, the respondent requests that the district court's judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Anything further?
I may have exhausted the time allotted.
Well, I'll give you a minute. Yeah.
With respect to the state's conclusion, it seems to me that that was a highly fact-based argument that would be appropriately made at the conclusion of the evidentiary hearing we seek, and is inappropriate here. With respect to the state's initial point that none of these can equal cause individually, therefore they can't in the aggregate, that reminds me a little bit of a defense lawyer, and I've tried this, saying that the evidence is legally insufficient because this item here doesn't constitute sufficient evidence, this item here, therefore, in the aggregate, they don't. The fact that they don't individually does not necessarily mean that they can't in the aggregate. The state, I'm sure unintentionally, misstates the record when they say that the district judge found that the allegation of borderline mental retardation is so conclusory. At page 12 of the appendix, where the statement appears, it is evident that she was referring there solely to the allegation regarding organic brain dysfunction and not the borderline mental retardation. And with respect, we disagree with that because I don't think that this allegation is any more conclusory than an allegation of, say, schizophrenia. Lastly, the other evidence that the state cites that they say is outside the record and that Harris was obviously aware of, these are things that he could reasonably be expected to have been aware of because they were within his own knowledge, his own experience. That distinguishes them from the factual predicate on which we rely here, which it is our position he could not reasonably be expected to have been aware of. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. And the case will be taken under advisement.